Group meeting, Saturday, 15th October, 1988.
Our basic concern with all these group meetings has been the art of living the religious life, which is no other than the daily human life, secular life, lived virtuously. Whether it be the business aspect, the domestic aspect, the spiritual aspect, or whatever it is. That aspect, all these aspects, lived virtuously, as far as I can see, make up the truly religious life, which is indeed the human life as such. Now, the world as a whole has put religion in a compartment by itself. This is religion, and this is everything else in our ordinary everyday life. Now, this is a fundamental misconception. It is completely wrong. It has had a great influence in producing the misery, the problems, the difficulties of the world. That means our own problems and difficulties and so on. There are those of us who, like ourselves here and in other such similar groups, who are concerned with trying to help the world to heal itself. But in order to help the world to heal itself, it is a case of physician, heal thyself first. So we have ourselves to become whole, wholesome, healthy, holy. They all mean the same thing. Now, I'm sure, especially those of you who have learned Latin, know the famous phrase, mens sana in corpore sano. A healthy mind in a healthy body. Of course, that statement, valuable as it is, has one flaw in it. It presents a dual aspect, body and healthy. Body and mind. Actually, we are a body-mind creation. That is what we are. Psycho-physical. We are not psyche and physique. We are psycho-physical organisms. That's the whole organism. Would you kindly just come over here and see whether this is moving as I speak? And it will be our task to ensure that we as psychophysical organisms become whole, healthy, very little. Whole and healthy, and ultimately holy as such. So now, let us start with what we are most conscious of, normally speaking, in our everyday life. And that is the organism as a physical organism, the body. Let us start with the earth on which we live, insofar as the planet is our habitat, and in which we live, insofar as our living organism is the apparatus through which life proceeds. And in this connection, I thought it might be useful to consider something which has been written in the heart of religion. Any of you are Greek scholars? Is the name pronounced Alcibiades, or is it pronounced Alcibiades?
Well, I was always brought up thinking it was Alcibiades.
Yes, so yeah. We were brought up that way. But as far as I am aware, there is no sound like C for the letter C in the English alphabet. The Romans introduced the C.
It's an anglicization, I suppose.
Yes, and it's anglicized.
Yes.
So if I use the Greek kappa, because it's spelled with a kappa, then it would be Alcibiades. And the meaning of the noun Alcibiades is that it was a kind of shoe. But it was the name of one of Plato's distinguished pupils. He was the son of a wealthy man, and he was somewhat inclined to use his wealth in ways which did not really conduce to truly religious living in our sense of the word. In other words, he was rather self-indulgent in certain ways. But he was a very useful pupil as such. Now, in Plato's Symposium, Alcibiades recounts this, the natural temperance, self-restraint, courage, and wisdom of Socrates. Socrates's extraordinary power of sustaining fatigue, of going without food, and his faculty of endurance of frost and ice in cold weather. He then describes how Socrates was thinking one summer morning while he was on the expedition to Potidaea about something which he could not resolve. Socrates stood there all through the day and the night until the following morning, and with the return of light he offered up a prayer to the sun and went his way. Socrates stands fixedly for a whole day and night calmly meditating. A century earlier, the Buddha tells some disciples of Nataputta, they were Jains, Nataputta was the founder of the Jain religion. I, Reverend Jains, this is what the Buddha says, am able, without moving my body, without uttering a word, to stay in meditation, experiencing nothing but bliss, for two nights and days, for 3, 4, 5, 6, for 7 nights and days continuously. Elena von Krebelsheim, Christian mystic, fell into an ecstasy lasting 5 days in which pure truth was revealed to her, and she was lifted up to an immediate experience of the Absolute. In his discourse on mindfulness of body, the Buddha tells his disciples that there are 10 advantages to be expected from this discipline, of which the third is as follows. The advantages are as follows. He is one who bears cold, heat, hunger, thirst, the touch of the gadfly, mosquito, wind and sun, creeping things, ways of speech that are irksome, unwelcome. He is of a character to bear bodily feelings which, arising, are painful, acute, sharp, shooting, disagreeable, miserable, and deadly. Sri Krishna says that the disciplined one is equable in cold and heat, pleasure and pain, and whether he is honored or insulted. The discipline which enables the body to remain impassible, you know, the meaning of the word impassible is that it is not hurt, needs to be intelligent. The discipline needs to be intelligent. Those who, like the Buddha or the Christian mystic Henry Suzo, practiced extreme austerities, put them aside in due time. From very early times, there is sensible and scientific instruction regarding food and drink. Sri Krishna says, yoga, and listen to this very carefully, because yoga does not mean just merely keep fit exercises. Yoga is not for him who eats too much, nor who abstains to excess, nor who is too much addicted to sleep, nor even to wakefulness. Men who are pure like food which is pure, which gives health, mental power, strength, and long life, which has taste, is soothing and nourishing, and which gladdens the heart of men. The Yoga Tattva Upanishad states, eating light meals is the most important discipline bodily. The Buddha says, be moderate in eating. Eat not for fun or pleasure or adornment or beautifying, but just enough for maintaining this body and keeping it going, for keeping it from harm, from furthering the brahma-faring, the holy life. If so many advertisers tried to follow this, they would go out of business. And the memoirs of Hegesippus, which he wrote about AD 70 at a very advanced age, says this about James, the brother of Jesus. James, the brother of our Lord, has been called the just from the days of our Lord to our own. From his mother's womb, he was dedicated to God. He drank no wine or other fermented beverage. He ate nothing living, that is, no meat whatever. And he alone was allowed to enter the Holy of Holies of the Jerusalem temple, where, prostrate or kneeling, he prayed that the sins of Israel might be forgiven. He was called Oblias, which means in Hebrew the bulwark, the wall, because all believed that only his prayers, the prayers of a saint, could save the people from the wrath of God. Then to all those quotations I add, must I abstain from meat and wine to live the religious life? The simple fact is that I cannot eat flesh food unless I myself kill a creature or am an accessory before and after the killing, unless I eat the flesh of an animal which has died a natural death. If I am sensitive to the fact that each creature loves its own life, perhaps more than I do mine, and often looks to me for protection and love, I find it difficult, impossible, to participate in senseless and brutal murder. As for wine, any intoxicant, narcotic, etc., must I be so foolish as to desensitize myself, deplete nervous energy, and lay myself open to inebriation? A word about fasting. The continued forcible deprivation of food, as by famine, war, and so on, is starvation. No good. Fasting is a judicious, voluntary abstention from food for a sensible period, say 1 to 3 days or so, as suitable to your own constitution. Very beneficial, usually. A convenient practical procedure is to carry out a 36-hour fast. No food after a light supper on, say, a Friday night until a light breakfast on Sunday morning. No smoking. Use good sense. Now, would you like to discuss that? Don't be afraid.
You started the discussion.
Look at that.
You started the discussion with the Buddha and one or two others going into meditation for days on end and getting the very deep states of consciousness which have come down to us since that time of what one should aim for. But this day and age, as we are, that's just a dream, isn't it? It's just so far away. When we do our meditation sort of daily for 20 minutes, one doesn't even consider sort of states of consciousness like that. All we can do is just be quiet in ourselves for a time and just try and be at peace with everything. How does the relevance of these deep states, what are we supposed to make of them? Are they just sort of to stay in the books, just as something to read?
Yes, I get your point, and I quite appreciate and understand the difficulty for most people in the world in this connection. Now we must remember that the Buddha, like all the great holy ones who were the true spiritual teachers of the world and were themselves the perfected holy ones, spoke from the deepest possible level of their own personal realization. They of course knew that the mass of people were not capable of living up to this to any considerable degree, or even in a minor degree, because they simply hadn't the capacity, the will, the understanding, the inner urge to live the holy life as such. The mass of people are tied up in worldliness as such, and the worldly life, to have a merry time, a happy time, to enjoy life as they call it, which means for them experience one pleasure after another. There is that, then there is the passion for success, the fulfillment of their ambitions, if they have any at all. Worthy ambitions are the hallmark of very few, very intelligent people. But apart from that, the rest of the world is consumed by its foolish ambitions. Now, of course the Holy Ones knew that there would be all this difficulty. But they, being what they were, had of necessity to fulfill their destiny as teachers of the holy life to those who cared to live the holy life, to those who were interested. Now, we can come across many people in our modern world who are interested in human welfare and well-being. But the problem is, how many people really know the meaning of human welfare and human well-being? In fact, how many people to start with know the meaning of the word human? They are aware, if they have had any education at all, that they are members of an animal species. We are one animal species, and we have the conceit, in some cases rightly, that we are the most advanced animal species. But the bulk of human beings merely have a foolish self-conceit that they are the masters of the world, the lords of creation and all that nonsense. So that their ambitions are directed only towards a way of life which enhances and perhaps brings to fruition all their worldliness. But the bringing to fruition of worldliness allows no release from the very difficult problems, the miseries, the sorrows which human beings suffer from. What people like ourselves have to bear in mind is all this, that it is necessary to know the meaning of the word human and what human welfare and well-being means. Because that derives directly from the meaning of the word human. You have heard me say it 100 times by now at least, that the word human means the happy creator. And to call and to say that the human is a happy creator is almost tantamount to saying that man is God. He has at least come to the stage where he merely as a matter of saying something believes that he is the child of God. But if he is truly the child of God, he is like God. If I am the child of a man and a woman, human man and woman, then I am like a human man and woman. I am not like a beast, but my behavior in life has all too often been that of a beast. And that is the case with humanity as a whole, the human race as a whole, for century after century. We must understand these things very, very deeply, and then if we can live up to that to some extent or other, and if we can at least uphold that sort of conception in some degree, then our whole environment is affected by it, and we can be helping others in the true way, the right way, the healthy way. What do you think?
wouldn't you say, Rose, that even short periods of meditation, as Michael's mentioned, 20 minutes once or twice a day, I don't know what you're talking about, is cumulative? Is cumulative?
Yes, yes.
You may not need such a long period, but it will build up.
Every little thing which we do in thought and feeling, in word and deed, helps towards building up an energy, a force, which not only benefits ourselves and brings us closer and closer towards a true human fulfillment, but affects the environment also. Then we have power which is of the right sort. Otherwise, power is always misused. The human race has suffered from this crazy pursuit of wealth and power in the wrong way. In order to utilize wealth and power rightly, we must have at least a modicum of harmony in terms of love and wisdom. Otherwise, we don't know how to use our wealth and power. And we need both aspects, love and wisdom. Wisdom for the intellectual knowing part and love for the human relationship part. If I don't love my neighbor, I am not going to help him. And the question arises, who is my neighbor? Not only anybody sitting near me or related to me in terms of family, not merely somebody who belongs to my community, but the man on the other side of the globe whom I've never seen is my neighbor. And not only is a human being my neighbor, but the whole of the animal world, the plant world, the mineral world, they are all my neighbors. A steam engine is my neighbor. A motor car is my neighbor. And if I treat it with love and wisdom, then I shall treat it in the right way. So that every attempt in terms of meditation, as you say, is cumulative. It helps cumulatively. And when it has come to fruition, you will find that the real meditation then begins. Because in the fruition of the meditative process which one practices, you culminate in that state of consciousness where you are no longer separate from anything and everything in the cosmos. And this is the real secret and lies at the heart of the whole thing. And in that divine state of complete unity with the totality, then your meditation truly begins. And that meditation, in four I have mentioned it, is a constant creative action in eternity, not a this, that or other good action in time and space, which is finite and temporal. It becomes infinite and eternal. And this is a tremendous thing to see and to understand and do.
It seems in a way that observation is a key. If one trains oneself to think when one needs to think and does not think when one does not need to think, then one becomes observant within and without. Then you learn to let circumstances tell you what they want to do. So your awareness increases. So it becomes quite easy to see another's need. And all the time one is doing this, of course, the ego, that part of our mind which jumps up and down and makes such a nuisance of itself, becomes quiescent. The wonderful thing is that when doing that, one becomes possessed of a quiet but intense joy. Now, there's no logic or reason in this. It is a thing that is. And when I'm faced with a task or a difficult person to deal with, in my mind I say, let it tell me. Keeping my mind quiet, then it is done. And one is refreshed and the other is helped. The power of being is truly immense. And I must say, women are awfully lucky, because I think you'll agree they have the power of being more developed than a man. Man has to work at it very hard.
Men being too extroverted.
Yes.
All the ladies have bowed to me.
Well, I'm not going to bow back.
Prose. Yes. Just another thing. When we try to practice our virtuous living,
yes,
and try and do this and think we're doing this and that right, and we're bombarded with all these cruelties and things, wars and famines that come into our lives every day via the news, it's very difficult to be calm and non-attached and just say, leave me alone, I want to be nice, just go away. You can't say that to these things. How you can't do anything to make the situation better. What should you, how should you sort of be at that time?
Invite the devil right into your own heart. Don't say, go away and leave me alone. Leaving me alone is the last thing to be done. One has to be completely open to anything and everything that goes on. Because it does go on, it characterizes the whole of the living process of mankind all over the globe. All these wars and strikes and whatnot and whatnot, and the cruelties and the horrors that we see. Don't try to push them aside or stand apart from them. You can't do it, because for the very simple reason that each and everything is completely and totally interrelated with and interactive with the universe. You can't shut yourself up in an ivory tower. It's impossible. So one has to be open to it. But all you have to do is not react for or against it. Supposing you see some very kind deed done, don't react for it. Observe it. You spoke about observation. Yes, observe it carefully. Don't shut any part of it out of your consciousness. Be wholly conscious as to what is going on and let it influence your whole psychophysical being. It will purify the whole psychophysical being and give you inward peace too by itself. If you react against it, then you are in a state of conflict. You are adding to the conflict. This is very difficult, of course. Everybody says it is so difficult to do this and live the virtuous life. But of course it is difficult to live the virtuous life. To live the human life means to live the life of creative action in eternity. Easy job? It's a devilishly difficult job. Devilishly merely meaning superlatively difficult job. But it has to be done. We must let it happen by not reacting either for or against. If you don't react for what is good, the good will become better. If you don't react against what is bad, the bad will be converted into the good because you are quiet. You see? This quietness, this inner silence, is the most difficult thing to bring into being.
You can respond to it as opposed to reacting.
Pardon?
Can you respond to it as opposed to reacting for or against it?
Yes. Now, very good. If you don't react for or against, then you are in a state, you will be in a state where you can make the right response to it. That means that your action in relation to it, you see, will be the right action, yeah. It will be the right view, the right thought, the right feeling. You see, we in the modern world have made a colossal blunder in suppressing feelings. Keep a stiff upper lip and all that nonsense. You see?
And so
keep a... Pardon?
Is not response a kind of reaction?
A true response is not a reaction. Look, the meaning of the word reaction is very much associated with Newton's third law of motion. You know, Newton's laws of motion, the third law was that action and reaction are equal and opposite. You see? Now, that means that if I press down on this stool with my thumb with a force, say, of 10 pounds, then that stool is reacting against my thumb with a force of 10 pounds. You see? Now, that is reaction in the real sense of the, in the real meaning of the word reaction. But that is no way of dealing with human beings, where human beings are concerned.
In a sense, the reaction is part of the past habitual, it's part of the habit that, which we're used to, whereas an action is something that can be very fresh and appropriate to the moment. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
So reactions are the habit of behaviour, and action is a chosen way of behaving.
The right response will always have the quality of love and wisdom and goodness in it, always. But a reaction will not have that.
But how do I turn all these feelings of pain and anger or aggression or despair into these good feelings you were talking about?
Sorry, I couldn't hear the word.
Sorry. How do I turn...
I heard only the word aggression.
Yeah. Aggression and anger and pain and despair. How do I turn that into the good feelings you were talking about? Mm. The response. I think I asked you that before.
The usual question of how to do it. The know-how. There is only one way of doing it. Look at it, don't reject it, don't say no to it, don't say, aggression, you are bad, you are evil, out with you. That will never do. Just watch it and see how it manifests itself, how did it arise, and then how did it proceed, and how is it working out in this, that or the other situation. When there is real understanding, because you are examining with love, not critically in the judgmatical way. You see, you are examining with love. And in that examination with love, that is, which is the real meaning of the word understanding, the healing takes place. Then there is a healing. All right, my dear, that's all right, I understand now. And so, my dear, aggression or anger begins to be a sweet little dear. You see, it's my own psychical energy, isn't it? And I'm dealing with my own psychical energy.
There's always the saying of Jesus on the cross, "Forgive them, Father, they know not what they do." And if people are doing things which are, we can see as being evil or cruel, they do not know what they are doing, because if they really were looking and observing, then they would know what they were doing and would not do it. And if we observe the participants in these horrendous situations with that, those principles in mind, then we can observe and, as it were, learn. If we can find out if we are doing anything like that ourselves. If we see somebody who has been making a bomb to kill innocent people, then I need to find out, am I in my own emotional life, am I manufacturing a psychological bomb which I turn on people that I find upset me? There's a Buddhist meditational practice of metta bhavana, and you first of all practice loving kindness towards yourself. Then you have to focus that loving kindness on somebody that you do not like, and that is a real challenge. But Christ, as always, is so helpful. They know not what they do, because if they really found out by observation what they were doing, they would be helped by the loving kindness principle to cease from doing what they are doing. So when you turn loving kindness on them, the perpetrators of these things, you are helping them to see for themselves what they are doing. Then they can stop, and you help them to stop. It's a struggle, of course, but that seems to me a way of trying.
But how can you turn loving kindness onto all those people, that the atrocities you see through television and through the news?
How can you turn loving kindness?
How can your loving kindness, if you can feel loving kindness, how can that be effective to the bomb perpetrators and the
kidnappers
or the child beaters or whatever? It's the wider aspect. I can perhaps turn loving kindness onto my neighbour whom I tend to dislike, perhaps. But it's the wider aspect that I find difficult to cope with.
The wider aspect meaning what happens in the country as a whole?
Yes, really.
Like IRA's activities? And
yes.
Well, what can you or I do with respect to IRA? But what we can't do anything about things on the big scale like that. You just can't. What we can deal with is first and foremost ourselves.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
If we deal rightly with ourselves and bring peace and harmony inside ourselves, then if one directs the energy of loving kindness and compassion towards anybody else, it may have some little effect, but only some little effect.
So is it best then not to discuss these atrocities that we hear so much about, not to talk about them and say how dreadful this is and how dreadful that is, to keep quiet and just concentrate on our own development towards loving kindness.
You see, Joan, one's own inner quietness is a tremendous power. It's a tremendous force.
To the IRA?
No, for good.
And anything and everything. But leave IRA alone at the moment, because you and I can't do anything about it. We can deal with ourselves. And as we grow in this power of healing that which needs healing, then there may come a time when the collective activity of so many people will bear fruit. See, after all, isn't it an extraordinary thing? In all the religious teachings of the world, Satan or the devil or Mara or whoever you like to name, you see, Ahriman, he's never slain. He's never destroyed. Why? All these are forces within ourselves, personified. God and the devil are personified aspects of our own being. All the pantheons, the Greek, the Scandinavian, the Indian, the Chinese, all these pantheons express their psychological teachings. They tell us what we ourselves are. You see, we can only deal with ourselves. Supposing I have a tummy ache. Well, I have to take the medicine which the doctor gives me for my tummy ache. I can't do anything else. And supposing you had a tummy ache, I couldn't cure it by loving kindness. Unless that loving kindness is embodied in the medicine that I, as a good doctor, would prescribe to you. Isn't that so?
Yes.
You see, these are very difficult. I know how difficult these problems are. I've been through them myself and known hell intellectually, intellectual distress of the highest order over all this. But it's no good being distressed. If I am distressed, then I exude a distressed atmosphere. But if I can remain quiet and calm, I exude a healthy and a peaceful atmosphere, and a healing atmosphere. Making whole is not easy.
And this is why great teachers draw people to them, because people do in fact feel this when they're close.
I'm sorry.
This is why great teachers do draw disciples to them. Jesus, the Buddha,
yes, yes.
Because there's something incredibly attractive,
exactly,
about goodness, and people feel it, and they want to be there so that they can participate, and perhaps become like it themselves. And that is how the person who is good is changing others around him.
Yes.
Not by actually saying, thou shalt do this, that, and not do the other, but just by being what they are.
Yes.
And other people want to be the same.
It is so important for each one to be himself or herself, as the case may be, and to let everybody else be themselves. This is the difficulty. And especially if they are strongly related to us, family-wise, it becomes extremely, extremely difficult.
Battle of the homework, for example. Yes.
What you're saying about the devil just now reminded me of a parable told by Sri Ramakrishna.
Oh.
He said a man was walking along a road and he came across a devil. And the devil was going about picking up things. The man said, "What are you picking up, devil?" The devil said, "I'm picking up truth." The man said, "But devil, what have you got to do with truth?" "Ah," says the devil, "I'm organizing them."
The devil doesn't leave others alone.